talk you done. But yeah, I think first of all, introduce Tom. My name's Si Hawkins. I'm from Clash magazine, which is this here from England. It's our 50th issue. We've been going since. I can't actually remember the year we started because I wasn't there. But we've been going a while, and we have a massive interest in American music. Tom is. Legendary, too strong word?
Yeah.
He's a renowned booking agent. I'd imagine you're kind of like one of the most respected booking agents in the US.
Fair enough.
You have a roster. I mean, you have a roster that demands respect. You have some good bands on there, let's face it.
Yeah.
So, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Tom Windisch. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, in the US. I own an agency called the Windisch Agency. I've been booking tours for 17 years. I started the Windisch Agency 6 years ago. At that time, I had about 50 artists and one employee, and we worked out of the second bedroom in my apartment. Now I have 24 employees and 400 bands on our roster. There's 10 agents. We have an office in New York. Big office in Chicago, and one employee in Chile. It's kind of grown by leaps and bounds. I never would have dreamed that I'd be sitting here, or that I'd be saying that we had 400 bands on our roster, because it sounds really big to me. But we actually, I'm very proud of the work that we do, the quality of the tours that we book. We have a very unique approach to developing touring careers in America, much different than all of our competitors. Some of the bands I book are Animal Collective and Hot Chip, The XX, Jose Gonzalez, The Knife, Viva Ray, and loads and loads more. We've got a lot of exciting stuff going on. Fundamentally, I like all the music that we book. People ask, like, how do we get on your roster? And that's the first step. Although these days, if another agent really wants to do something, I tend not to hold them back.
Do you have arguments?
Sometimes I suggest the agents kind of step back and really think about what the longevity of this artist is, or how much time they're going to be able to spend in the United States, how realistic they are in terms of how much they expect to get paid.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that I suppose because I'm a journalist, so I generally deal with PR people and the artists themselves. So the booking agents is, I suppose it's becoming an industry that's more and more important, because as an example, I remember interviewing the band Soulwax, and or Too Many DJs, whichever incarnation they're in. And one of the guys said, we were publicising this album. And he said, to be honest, we only really release albums now to publicise the tour. Which is a pretty sort of jaw-dropping statement, I think. Because of download generation, it seems like the live work is basically the only surefire way of making money these days. I mean, is that changing your industry? Is booking agency becoming a bigger deal than it used to be?
Yeah, it's definitely. Yeah, I mean the rise of the company kind of happened at the same time that a lot of the changes in the way people consume music like really started becoming mainstream. So I'm talking about listening to music on the internet, downloading music for free. Stuff like that. I find that the audiences are much, much larger now for bands than they used to be. That doesn't necessarily mean the audience of people that are purchasing recorded music, but our clients are playing to way more people than they would have 10 years ago or something. And the speed at which they go from A to Z, or zero fans to 10,000 fans, is just kind of stunning to me.
Is that because of the download? I mean, people are picking up and stuff straight away, they can sample it.
Yeah, I think it totally has to do with how easy it is to hear about things. You know, it used to be that, you know, I would walk into a record store and ask the person behind the counter what they were listening to that week that I might like. And it's still a very organic process of, you know, there's a connection with other people that are sort of tipping each other off about things that they like. But, you know, then I'd have to, like, buy the record, go home, listen to it, go back to the record store, like, a week or two later when I had saved up enough money again, and kind of ask the same question again. And it took a long time to become fans of lots of different bands. Nowadays, you know, you ask your friend, what are you listening to? And boom, you know, you check it out on MySpace, you can rip it, they can send it to you through iChat or something. I mean, you can also buy it. It's just so fast. We've had a lot of bands. I mean, I guess the XX are the most obvious example these days, but the first show I booked for them was in August last year. There were 50 people there in New York City, and now they can sell about 15,000 tickets in New York. And that's just the most current example. The first show I booked for Hot Shit was for 200 people in New York, and they kind of like went around for about a year selling about 200 or 300 tickets, and now they can sell 5,000 to 10,000 tickets in 10 or 15 markets. They're also not really selling that many records. It's definitely not in line with how many tickets they're selling. We have a lot of bands that sell way more tickets than actual albums. Mike Snow's another good example right now. Who's selling loads and loads of tickets, and the album sales aren't very good.
So could you, I suppose, explain a little bit about exactly what you do and the difference between, say, a booking agent and a manager, and for people who may not know exactly what you actually do and at what stage you get involved with an artist and where you leave it and move on to other people?
I mean, all we really do is negotiate the fees for the live shows that our artists play. Some agencies in other parts of the world do a lot more things than we do. In America, the various services are still kind of separated. So, you know, we book the shows. An artist will come to us, and you know, we agree to work together, and we'll kind of work out the time period, how many shows they want to play, what markets are make sense strategy wise, and then we go out to all the venues and say, all right, this artist is available. What do you have during, you know, what dates are available during this time period? We sort out a routing, and then we negotiate the fee. So, you know, talk about the ticket prices, what we think the artist is worth, confirm it, contract it, get the signed contract back, and deliver it to the artist. And everything else is kind of their responsibility. We don't tour manage the shows. We don't promote the shows. We don't get people to go. The clubs are kind of supposed to do that, but realistically, the clubs aren't going to do that much to promote your show. The reason is that they have at least, you know, 3 or 4 other bands playing that night at their club. They often have like several venues, so you know they're booking like thousands of bands a year. They're not going to single out one band and go crazy, you know, promoting it.
So this is about the US live industry as opposed to the European or whatever ones perhaps we're more used to. American tours, I always think of American tours as for bands basically going nuts and breaking up. And if you hear about a band breaking up or falling out or musical differences, it's usually happened before, during, or after the American tour. So that's what I generally think of as. I don't know what your experience of the European market is, but actually touring America does seem like it's a hell of a something to take on. I mean, you've got to work out whether you're doing New York and LA or New York and California or all that's in between. I mean, are there like massive full on every state tours you're doing? I mean, how different is it to what your understanding of like the European touring industry is?
I mean, you know, tours can be pretty long. In the when I first started, I would book these bands that would just play and play and play. They were kind of bands that were in Maximum Rock and Roll or something.
Yeah.
And you know, they would play at some kid's garage or basement or an established club. They just wanted to stay on the road. I would book tours that were 2 months long, 60 days, sometimes a show every single day, often. And we still book tours that are pretty long. I just booked a tour for like five or six weeks for School Seven Bells, where they play like five or six shows in a row, take a day off, do it again. I guess that's longer than tours are in Europe. I've never booked a tour in Europe, so I'm not totally sure. That's always the way I've done it. If you're a foreign artist wanting to tour America, one strategy that we often use is to have the act come and play in New York and kind of do as much as possible in New York during that trip. So, for instance, the XX, their first tour of the U.S. was last August, and they played 7 shows in New York, including like Brooklyn and Manhattan, basically. 7 shows in 8 days. So the first day was 50 people, second day 100 people. We had them on like a free series where they played in front of like 5,000 people that were just kind of at a beer fest kind of thing. Open up for another band one day, play another tiny 150 capacity club the next, and just kind of hope the idea is that momentum and people chattering about the artists will kind of snowball.
So if there's if the show in New York goes well, there's enough papers and New York Times goes around.
Yeah, well, New York Times would be huge if that happened.
So if something like that happens, or just blogs, or the New York-based media, then that will spread to the rest of America.
Yeah. I mean, if you play a bunch of well-attended shows in New York, chances are a bunch of blogs are going to pick up on it, and all of a sudden you're going to have a lot more interest in other markets. So then the second tour might be coming back to New York, doing it again. Maybe instead of just kind of taking whatever you can get for 7 or 8 days, shorten it down to like 3 shows and maybe try to get like 1 support slot, and instead of like a 50 capacity club, a club that fits 200 or something.
And festivals as well? Are you putting people into festivals in the States?
That's kind of much further on.
Yeah.
I mean, if we can get an artist on a festival the first time they've been in the U.S., great. And sometimes we can, I guess, but... this is just for like a brand new developing artist.
Mm.
So we'll come back, play New York, and then we'll have them play multiple shows in LA as well. And you know, the theory is the same thing will happen there. Interest will kind of snowball, and people will see them the first night in LA and tell their friends, and some of those people that heard about it will go on the next night. And then it happens again the following night. And by then, you've got like kind of a little buzz happening in New York and LA.
Yeah.
And then people in San Francisco start hearing about it, and Toronto and Seattle. And the third tour might kind of sort of be a more major market tour where you hit 10 cities or 8 cities or something.
So you're talking about a new band there. You've got a band who nobody in America maybe knows about. Probably. Going to be a certain amount of people who do because of the internet now. So when you go about acquiring, but if you look at your roster, it's like kind of like, I'm talking about this the other day, I think, and it's kind of like the best label in the world because you're a booking agent, you're not actually a label. You can basically, start off with Animal Collective down the alphabetical list. It's an amazing, it's like every band you like, you know, it's amazing. How do you go about acquiring those acts? People here, probably from some new bands here and stuff. Do you ever take a band to just... Because I've noticed it myself, like Danish bands, like Alcoholic Faith Mission, Oh No, I've got PR, because I used to work for O Magazine in the States, so I still get American PR people come to me sometimes. And I'll get PR press releases about Scandinavian bands from American PRs before I hear anything from British PRs. So does that happen? I mean, would you ever pluck a band from something like this festival and try it out in America? Maybe even before, you know, like Germany or the UK.
I like there to be some form of team in America, so it's not just me talking to people about how great this band is. So that could mean just having a publicist.
Mm.
Ideally, it means a little bit more than that, like a manager or a label and a publicist. That'd be good. And if it was a band I really liked and those two or three people were people that I've worked with and you know they're confident in it, I'd be a lot more likely to take it on.
Yeah.
I have taken plenty of things on that I was just going on gut instinct and you know just I like this, and that's worked out very well in some cases and hasn't worked out well at all in many more cases.
Is there any way? I mean, is there any? You know, if you try to do a statistical analysis of you know how a band is going to work and how it isn't going to work, is there any way of really seeing an underlying trend of what works in the States and what doesn't?
No. I think it's total, well, I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of the music and judging what is going to strike a chord. Yeah, I just kind of ask myself, does it strike a chord with me?
Yeah.
And I don't really try to think, or, you know, or I don't like this, but maybe lots of other people are going to like this. I don't make that step, you know?
Yeah.
I only book things that I like. If I started trying to figure out what I think other people would like, I don't know, I think it becomes a lot more commercial then. There have been cases in my career where I've taken things on because it makes money. And thankfully, I don't have any of those right now. Every time I've done that, I've regretted it. Pretty much like after the first phone call I had to make on behalf of the artists, and I knew like, and sometimes I'll rationalize in my head, like tell myself these guys are really good, they're really talented musicians, they're great, they're really good people. And then I pick up the phone and I don't know, it's like the heart of that I have in like selling the band, it's just the passion that I have is not there. And then the bands inevitably like just start complaining about the amount of money they're making. And
Have you had it where you've actually like totally heart overhead, where you've loved the band so much, but really deep down you should have thought that this is not going to work in America, but you booked it anyway because you liked it so much? And
well, these days when I find if you're so passionate about something, you should do it. And like, because so many different types of things are getting really popular. When I first heard the XX, I was like, pretty good, and you know, I was like, well, I really like this, but I don't know how many people are really gonna like this. Mm-hmm. And that thing struck a chord with tons of people. When I started booking Animal Collective, I mean, the first couple of records, I was thinking like, some of this is awful, like almost unlistenable, you know. But they're so cool, you know. I gotta do this. And they were drawing like next to nobody and making like $500 a night for a couple of years when I first took them on, and I really didn't, when I pick up any band, I'm not thinking like, all right, this is gonna go on to sell 10,000 tickets. And with them, I really would never have predicted that they would have gotten popular. One of the last shows we did for them in New York was 17,000 people.
Mm.
Insane, you know, like getting paid six figures and stuff. And I remember when making $1,000 was a really big deal. You know, I would like call them up like, you wouldn't believe it. We got a college.
I mean, Animal Collective just came out with this film, which is the weirdest thing. It's a visual album, apparently. And I'm arguing with someone about it. It's weird stuff, isn't it? I mean, they're not a commercial band, really. So the landscape's changed completely, hasn't it, Julie, since you, because you started off working for other people, and you started off at what, college, booking bands, and...
I started, I got into the whole thing when I was in college. I joined the college radio station. That was kind of a fluke. I liked music a lot, but a friend of mine was like, oh, we should join the college radio station, it'd be really fun, and that never really crossed my mind. And I was like, oh, okay. And I joined it, started doing radio a lot, and that kind of became my social network. all my friends were radio DJs. And I did loads of shows. I went to this kind of smaller school in upstate New York, and there weren't many people at the station, so I had like tons of hours on the station. And I used that time to learn about music.
Mm.
I had these like slots from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. and stuff, and I would just play anything, you know, and no one would call or, you know, no one was listening. But I had a blast. And that radio station put on like one concert a year, and my friend was the guy who put on the show. I think they were doing, I think it was the Feelies. And he came to me like towards the end of my freshman year and said, I'm dropping out of school. Do you want to learn how to put on shows for the radio station? It'd be really, really cool. And by that point, I was already pretty obsessed with like music and stuff. And I had been going to a bunch of shows, and I was like, yeah, totally, let's do it. So he taught me how to book shows. And I decided instead of booking one show for the radio station, I would try and book smaller bands, charge a little bit of money, and do like three or four shows. So the following year, I booked like three or four shows. I think I had like Robin Hitchcock solo, and what else? I don't know, some small stuff, Supertrunk and Unrest or something. And towards the middle of my sophomore year, this guy came to me and said, my job is to appoint the person in charge of concerts for the whole college. And the only shows I've gone to this year are the ones that you brought. So would you want to be in charge of the whole thing? And I went from having a budget of like $4,000 to $100,000. There was no board. It was just me. I just would go to this guy and say, hey, I'm thinking about bringing Sonic Youth. And he'd say, great, go for it, you know. And every once in a while, he'd say something like, you gotta get They Might Be Giants. You gotta do that. So I got They Might Be Giants.
Do you miss those days?
It was pretty cool. And in doing that, I started dealing with a lot of agents. I got an internship at William Morris Agency when I was a junior, and decided, like, I want to be an agent. I ended up not going back to college after my junior year, and I got a job at Knitting Factory. They had a record label back then, and I had done some stuff with some of their like avant-garde jazz bands in my college. And so my job was book tours for bands on Knitting Factory Records. The most notable one was John Zorn. And I got paid like next to nothing to work there, like below minimum wage. But I was allowed to book some bands that I brought in that weren't on Knitting Factory Records. So I had these little bands that made $100 a night or whatever that I just worshipped. And after like 2 months or something, I had all these calendars, like one for each band, kind of stuck up on the wall. And my bands, one of them was Smog, another one was Low.
Yeah.
I still book Low. Their calendars were completely full. Every day there's something going on. And then there'd be the Knitting Factory band calendars, and it'd be like one show, maybe like the crossed out or something.
Is that because you were just, I mean, because it sounds like John Zorn is the, I mean, that's the most avant-garde kind of jazz guy in New York, I think. Is that because you had a bit more of a commercial bent already? You're already kind of thinking what's going to be successful?
No, I mean, I don't think I was really thinking about what I thought would be successful. It was just stuff I liked.
Yeah.
I mean, I really didn't think Low was going to be successful. You know, they were like the quietest, slowest band I'd ever heard. And I was booking them in rock clubs where they were being talked over like 90% of the time. But there was still something great about it. It was because nobody wanted to book these avant-garde jazz bands, and especially at the price that they wanted to get paid. John Zorn was one thing. Like, I could get him some shows, but he wanted like a ton of money. So anyway, I didn't work at Knitting Factory Records very long, booking tours. So then I moved my little agency of probably like four or five bands into this apartment. Moved to Chicago, kind of randomly, because I found some people there that offered me a place to live for like $100 a month. It was above of this rock club called Lounge Axe. And Lounge Axe is like the CBGBs, it was like the CBGBs of Chicago, but it was a legendary place. After a couple, after 6 months or something, I merged my agency into a company called Billions. I was the first agent that worked there besides the owner, and I worked there for 8 years, built up my roster to 50 artists, and 6 years ago I left. I kind of decided that there were structural things I could do with a company to where I could serve my clients a lot better than they were being served.
Yeah.
And it was basically just basic fundamental stuff, like
just a more hands-on, touchy-feely approach.
The main thing was you know, we have people whose job is to send out the contracts, call people up and get them sent back, to take accounts, put together tour books, and my bands were just not a priority for the people whose job, you know, who had those jobs. And I was like, if I have someone whose job it is to get the contracts back for me, they'll do it a lot faster. And I found myself kind of doing all that stuff at the last minute. I was ringing up clubs constantly saying, send the contracts back, to the show's tomorrow. And it's not a good position to be, it's not a professional position to be with an artist, you know.
So if you, I mean, if anyone here wanted to become a booking agent, is that a route? I mean, that sounds like that's a fairly convoluted roller coaster route you've done there, but you couldn't really follow that. But I don't know, has that industry changed? I mean, can you still sort of follow that path? It starts more, you know,
some
experience at some big companies, maybe.
I think there's, well, two ways that most people go about it. One would be just get a job as an assistant at an agency, and then move up. And I've hired a bunch of people that as assistants or administrators, we call them, who have moved up and become agents. The other way to do it is start your own agency and just book tours. And you know, who knows how big it gets. I've hired two people that had their own agencies beforehand. And some people that start their own agencies like stay independent forever. But yeah, that's the two ways to do it.
So for a band, say, or an artist who, I don't know, has reached a certain level and wants to start making that jump, you, for a start, Oliver Arnolds from Iceland, who's a very talented musician, as certainly in England gets a lot of press, sells out shows, bit of interest in America. How'd you get that next step so that interest in America is fine, you get a few downloads, you're not making any money. How do you get to that step where someone can interest you or someone, are there other agents, more independent style agents like yourself over there?
Not really.
No, okay, you then. How do they attract your attention? What's the next step for them?
It's really nice if we start hearing about bands through blogs, through press. You know, these days it's funny how early we have to be onto things. You know, I'm often chasing bands that have only played a couple shows in their career. But these bands also have 10 other agents chasing them. And, you know, Pitchfork basically just said they're the next great thing. And probably 30 or 40 other blogs have said the same thing. And there's A&R people. I just, you know, chasing them like crazy. I just picked up a band called Colts from New York. And there were a lot of agents that wanted to book them. They never played a show. They have 3 songs. One song is really good. And I picked them up, and I had about 20 A&R people contact me like almost instantly saying, oh my god, you booked this band, how do we reach them? We want to sign them. I've had, you know, people like the music director of Twilight, the movie, you know, contact me and like,
yeah.
Wow, we got to get in touch with this band to have them in Twilight. Lots of things like that happen. And they went and played their first show, and it wasn't very good. And a lot of people came back to me and said, wow, they're really not very good. And I'm like, yeah, well, they haven't played a show before. it's strange times. I have like a handful of bands kind of like that. It's so early, there's so much interest, and part of what I have to do is book shows under different names and in like dive clubs in like the middle of New Jersey, so that nobody goes. And then A&R people still find a way to figure it out somehow and go.
Yeah. Anyone quite who's like, you know, a successful touring band now who would have done a show under an assumed name in New Jersey?
It's kind of a new phenomenon for me. I have another group called Penguin Prison. Same thing is happening. There's a lot of A&R people want to sign them. They hadn't played any shows. And now I book like one show a month. Sometimes we advertise the name of the band, sometimes we don't.
So you're not actually just booking bands because they're any good live, which you'd imagine is a prerequisite.
Yeah, it's strange. It's really strange. I mean, when I started, like, the quality of the live performance was, you know, the most important thing to me, because that was what I was selling. These days, you know, I look at things and I go with like the quality of a few of those songs and my gut feelings, and I think they're going to write a lot more songs that are really good, even if they haven't done it yet. And even if they haven't played a show yet, I think they might figure it out. And I guess I've matured. I don't know, I've come a long way. I've seen a lot of bands that haven't been very good in the beginning. The first Hot Chip shows that I booked were kind of a disaster. All the equipment would fall apart, and you know, they would stop and start constantly. It wasn't just at one show. You know, it was like almost every show was a meltdown.
They're still fairly ramshackle now, aren't they? They still have that whiff of school band about them.
Yeah, but they're fantastic. I mean, they get up there and just blow through stuff for 75 minutes or something. And if something breaks, they have like three backups now, and someone comes out and plugs it in, and you know, cool. Keep going. The touring industry in America is in a strange place. If I wasn't taking these things on, someone else, another agency would. You know, probably another agency that's much bigger than mine.
Well, I was talking to a couple of guys at a big major label a couple of months ago, and we were talking about the act I was just about to interview. And they said, they were the record label, and they were like freaked out, clearly. And they were desperately trying to do deals with presumably booking agents. I mean, presumably a Live Nation or, booking agent. So Live Nation is kind of, is that a booking agency?
Live Nation is a promoter, so I call up Live Nation and negotiate the fees with them.
But artists now like Donna, I think, is she? They're actually doing deals.
Yeah,
the way they used to do record deals, they're now doing live deals that way.
Yeah, they've kind of pulled back on that, like basically offering 360 deals. So they did one with Jay-Z, and they said to him, "We're going to give you $350 million, and you got to do this, and this. We get your record sales, we get your merch, or a chunk of it or something. You have to play this number of shows. We get to do them." They've really scaled back on that, though.
These guys are saying, we're really desperately trying to go. We're actually going to the live agents now, and going to them and saying, look, you have to give us some money. Because they weren't making any money on record sales, and it was all coming from live concerts. For this particular artist, who I haven't mentioned, but... So, I mean, does that happen with you and what you do? I mean, are you getting labels coming to you saying, look, we need to sort something out, because the way a deal that was signed a few years ago has now... The industry's evolved to that extent where you suddenly have the power and they don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely has changed a lot. And I have had some really strange conversations with labels, especially major labels, about what's going to happen. I'm not a really big fan of 360 deals from a label side in America, anyway. There seem to be examples around the world where they work. You know, I met a couple people... the last couple days who promote the shows, manage the band, put out the records, do all that. It seems like when it's a smaller, more cottage industry, that can work very well. I don't really trust major labels to handle it splendidly. I more find that they just want to get in there and get money however they can, but they don't bring a level of expertise to these extra things. They just want to take part of the money. They've come to me with some of the strangest questions, you know, saying like, now if we wanted to take 20% of the gross ticket sales from, you know, an artist that was on our label, you know, how do you think that would go down? And I say, well, you know, let's say you have $10,000 raised at the door, the artist doesn't get paid $10,000. They get paid maybe $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. It varies, like, in every venue. And it's because of the cost to put on the show for the club. So I'll say, well, the band only gets, like, $4,000 or something. You know, you're talking about 20% of the gross. That's $2,000. So you're going to get half the money that the artist's getting. I don't think that's going to work, you know. But, yeah, I haven't really, like, found a good 360 deal that's really working yet.
So the industry still, because it's like two, it's like separate industries really, isn't it? Presumably they're now trying to work out a way of, it's going to take a while for this to get sorted out really, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's going to be one way that things are done. I think there'll probably be lots of different types of stories. But, you know, some of these businesses where the artist kind of controls everything, through a manager or something, I could see that working.
Mm. So should we take some questions now or 10 minutes? What time is it? 11:50.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So if you were as I said earlier on about the I could see maybe the American tour as being like, you know, a lot of European bands go over there and it's really, they've certainly stressed about it beforehand. What experiences have you had with European bands going over? I mean, what are the problems that European bands might face if they're just about to embark on their first trips to? Is there anything they shouldn't? Are there any do's and don'ts?
Some of the hurdles are money, being able to afford to go there, it's expensive. The visa, that costs about $2,000. The rules change every so often. I don't completely understand the rules most of the time. Taxation. Bands are now subject to have about 30% of their money withheld as this foreign entertainer tax. That's new as of like 2 years ago. There are ways you can get around that, but it costs money. Another thing is when you get to the U.S., whether or not people go to the shows. So you could spend an awful lot of money and end up playing to no one.
Yeah, I suppose that's the unforeseen. You just don't know the year, really.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, the way to make things work, without taking into consideration how much money it costs, but the more shows you can play in America, in a strategic way, the more you can play, the better chance you have of something actually working. So, you know, a lot of stuff we do is the band comes over to New York, plays a bunch, gets a buzz in New York. They come back again, play New York again, play LA, get a buzz going there. Then start hitting some other markets. Let's say they do a 10-city tour. Hopefully, you know, people come out in the other cities too. Maybe by that point there's enough chatter about the band where some other bands are going to ask you to go on tour with them, either like opening or packaging or something. So you do that. Then you come back again on your own and bring a cool band to open maybe. Throw in like South by Southwest, CMJ, hopefully like festivals start caring, and want to book you. The landscape in the U.S. with festivals is completely different than Europe. We really don't have many. There's 6 major festivals, and then there's maybe 20 or 30 like small ones. We've got like Lollapalooza, Coachella, Bonnaroo, Austin City Limits, and Sasquatch. And, you know, every band in the world wants to play on them, and they only have, like, I don't know, 75 to 150 slots each. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's how we go about doing things.
Yeah, yeah.
If the festivals don't want to book them, you know, we just have them go back and play the clubs again, you know. We're always looking for the best situation possible. One way that we're a lot different than other agencies is that we're constantly looking for unique shows. Most agencies just kind of call up the main promoter in every town. That could be Live Nation, it could be, you know, some independent that's been around for 20 or 30 years. And that they sell like every single show to these promoters. We've gone out for the last 6 years and tried to figure out everybody who would ever put on a live music event, and sometimes people who wouldn't even. So, for example, the Guggenheim Museum in New York, they didn't really have bands play. And we went to them and said, you should have bands play. And we said that for like 2 years. And then they were like, all right, we'll have a band play. We have this night, you know, what do you got? And we had the band play, and thousands of people went. We've done that hundreds and hundreds of times, and we've got these relationships with people who put on all sorts of events and parties, like at the museums, like I mentioned, or at colleges. Then there's also all sorts of corporate parties. It could be like Vice Magazine and some tequila company presents, you know, a free party, or it could be, you know, something more corporate like American Express or whatever. Then there's also like, there's a kid who has the coolest Monday night in every town. There's another kid who has the coolest Tuesday night. In some towns, like say New York City, there's the guy who has the greatest Tuesday night techno night. And there's another guy who has the greatest Tuesday night R&B night. And there's people like just go to these things. And we try really hard to book, especially the new artists, at these events when they make sense. Because it gets them in front of people instead of just coming over and playing 100 capacity club, but potentially to no one. And, you know, playing to people is like the way that, you know, that buzz starts.
So it's always gone back to the old days, isn't it? So that live, just going out and playing live was the way people started off, you know, rock and roll in the first place. And the internet is almost the most technological thing out there, but it's actually almost meant to go back to the old days. You just go out and play gigs there, really. You know, that's where you make your money.
Yeah, we book as many shows as our bands want to play. Even that band Colts that I was talking about that hadn't played a show and then wasn't very good at their first show, we've now set up about 75 shows for them. They're going to go out there and play every night, and they'll be good by the time they get back.
Yeah.
I have no doubt.
So should we pick your brains then? What's has anyone got any questions? Anyone who has who is an artist or has a band and has a question first? Any questions?
Well, I'm wondering, you're usually talking about breaking artists through touring, like making them a tour relentlessly until people catch on. Do you have many artists that you've actually broken through, like not going that way, rather just like, for example, European artists that could only go over there two times a year for five shows? Does that work in America, or do artists actually have to go over there for like 3 months to play 100 shows?
Well, you don't have to do 3 months and 100 shows. Yeah, and a lot of these things, when I say go there a lot, that could just mean like, all right, go to New York, do a week there,
yeah,
and go away, and come back 3 months later and do New York and LA, total of a week, go away again, come back 3 months later, or 6 months later or something, when you've got some new material, and do 8 cities. You can do that in like 10 days or something. You don't have to like spend 3 months necessarily. I do have plenty of bands from Europe and foreign countries that come over not very often. And if they're developing and trying to get an audience, like, it can be very slow. You know, sometimes it just doesn't happen because there's not, the buzz builds up, but then it goes away, you know, so they're like constantly restarting. I have other artists that, you know, we have 400 artists on our roster, and about 100 of them barely do anything. Aphex Twin is one of my best examples. I've booked him for 10 years. I booked one show. He still has a great buzz. So it's possible to not do much at all. But you know, the more you work, the better chance you get, I think.
Yeah. I was wondering, to many European bands these days, the Magic Formula is going to South by Southwest, and then your fortune is made. What's your take on that?
I don't think that's true. If my clients want to play South by Southwest, I book tons of great shows for them there. I think there's a lot of other ways to go about doing things. It's the same with CMJ. I think you can play New York any time of the year and get a lot out of it. You can go during CMJ, get a lot of it out of it as well. Often if I have an artist that wants to play CMJ, I'll recommend that they come into New York the weekend before so they can play shows in New York to like just New Yorkers, whether that's the New York music industry or just, you know, hipster fans or whatever, and then stick around the following week or play CMJ on the Wednesday and Thursday so that they can play to those people who are just in town for CMJ. So I think that's like college radio programmers and maybe some people come in from other cities for it. South by Southwest has an awful lot of bands. I think it's a good place for a band to kind of launch a new album or something once they've got a team in place, but not really a great place to go be discovered, I think. There are, you know, every year there are things that are discovered there, but I even think a lot of those are sort of planned, you know, by business teams and stuff, and well planned.
We're at like the Danish version of South by Southwest to a certain extent. What, how useful are these events? I mean, you've presumably been to a few of these. Would you book a band for a show like this, or is this an early warning of what they're like, and you know, maybe you'll then see if there's a buzz and then see if they're feasible for America?
I would definitely potentially book something that I saw here. Yeah, I go to things like this fairly often, and I've taken things on. Some have gone well, some haven't gone well.
Cool. So it's potential.
One more question.
Okay, you said that South by is not necessarily the best place. Would you recommend any better places? And then another quick one. How does the relationship between the agency and the management work, and how often these are, you know, there are conflicting interests, or how closely and how important the relationship is?
I mean, to me, a better plan than South By is, you know, this thing where I was talking about, go to New York and play a lot, and then come back and do New York and LA, play a lot. Maybe once you've done that, you go to South By. Or after you've done like one tour of major markets, you go to South By. So that when you're at South By, people actually have heard about you and go see you, and you can get better shows. We work very closely with management, and we don't really have a tug of war with them or conflicts with them. Really, like, the artist's careers belong to the artist, and I'm providing a service. I do what they tell me to do. I don't really throw around or even often have like strong opinions on what should be done. I don't think there's like one way of doing things that guarantees success. And there isn't necessarily like one way of doing things that even increases the chances, you know. I've pushed my artists to do some things before, and they've passed on them and they've gone on to great things. But it's the same with South By. You know, if an artist says we want to do South By, we'll go out and like make sure that we get the best possible schedule for them at South By. We just, you know, whatever cards we are dealt, we make the best of it.
So basically, yeah, just round up. It's basically, for a new band, basically, it's potentially could make it in America, or you may not. It really is completely random, isn't it?
It's a,
completely
I mean,
random, but you just don't know.
It's a more exciting time now than it's ever been for music.
That's a good last word.
Tom and Cy, and thanks for sharing your knowledge about the American market. We'll have a new setup with the people sharing their knowledge in 10 minutes. Thanks, a big applause.